This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
So joining me now is Dr. Philip Best from the University of Edinburgh, and you're here to talk to us today about a problem with galaxies, particularly the number of galaxies. Tell us a little bit about the problem that we face.
This is a problem with something we call the galaxy luminosity function. So this is the number of galaxies that there are in the universe as a function of how bright they are. So the fact that what we observe is a large number of faint galaxies and a much smaller number of bright galaxies. Now with our models of galaxy formation, we can predict roughly how many galaxies there should be as a function of brightness, but historically, there's been a long-standing problem that we've never been able to get this to match quite what we observe.
So how do we actually observe these galaxies, the number of galaxies? We simply take a telescope and look towards direction of sky and count the number of bright and faint galaxies?
Yes, it's simply that. With a spectroscopic survey, so you can tell how far they are away, some of the major surveys that have been carried out, like the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey or the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So you measure the galaxies, how many there are in a given volume of space that are bright and that are less bright.
Generally, we expect to see more faint galaxies than bright galaxies, simply because there are going to be more further away. The volume is going to be larger further away.
Well, this is faint as in terms of the luminosity. So we observe more that appear faint, but this is actually faint as in that they're intrinsically less luminous,
right.
So they have sort of lower masses, lower numbers of stars makes them less luminous, and we observe more faint ones. This is a thing that we see when we look at galaxies at all wavelengths, in the optical, in the radio, in the X-rays. There's always more faint things than there are bright luminous objects.
Is this for a very good reason, or is this just the way it is?
Well, largely this is the way it is. This is about how galaxies form and how structure forms in the universe through the coming together of dark matter. So dark matter particles, which are the particles that we can't see in the universe, not normal, what we call baryonic matter, the stuff you and I are made out of. These are the predominant form of mass in the universe is this dark matter, and this clumps together hierarchically, so it grows as the universe evolves from the early stages, coming together in initially in very small clumps, and then those small clumps merge up into larger and larger clumps. And this is something that we can model very well. The predominant force that's involved is just gravity, and we understand gravity very well indeed. And now In recent years, we've got a very good measurement for the cosmological parameters of the universe, the typical density of the universe, and the lambda, the so-called cosmological constant, and the Hubble constant as well. With all of these as inputs, we can model incredibly well how the dark matter should clump and grow together in the universe, and it forms in many more of the smaller clumps than the larger clumps. Now, the problem with galaxy formation is that physics of baryonic matter, the sort of the gas and that makes stars and the particles that make you and I, this is much more messy. There's more than just gravity involved. There's many other forces that are involved in these, and many other processes that come in. I mean, you get this obviously it falls under gravity like the dark matter does to form clumps, form galaxies, but these then form stars. Stars reheat their environment, which heats the gas. At the end of a star's life, it goes off in a supernova, the most massive stars at least, and they feed back a lot of energy into their environments. And so there's a lot of, if you like, more messy physics that goes on in terms of galaxy formation. And this is the problem that's long faced astronomers, is how then to understand from our picture of how many dark matter clumps there are as a function of mass, how many galaxies there should be as a function of luminosity. And that's a much more difficult problem.
So we can simulate the universe in terms of the dark matter quite well. Well, we think we can do it quite well because we only are dealing with gravity and we understand gravity well. So there have been large simulations which will model a universe comprised mainly of dark matter, which is what we believe the universe is actually made up. And we let the thing run. Little clumps of dark matter form, and then they coalesce, they merge, they get bigger, and we have a universe of dark matter structures. Now, what you're saying is that the formation of a galaxy is not just arising from a dark matter clump. There's going to be stars made of baryonic matter like you and I, influencing the way that the galaxy itself is being formed, not just through the action of gravity. To return to the problem that we mentioned right at the start, we have a mismatch between what these simulations are telling us about how many galaxies of what brightness should be and what we actually observe. Tell us a little bit more about exactly these differences.
Yes, so there's long been a problem from the very first galaxy formation models that were made, that essentially our models of galaxy formation predicted far too many faint galaxies or low luminosity galaxies and far too many bright high luminosity galaxies. But they actually got it about right for galaxies close to the mass of our own, things like the Milky Way. Now, the issue of the faint or low luminosity galaxies has been understood for some 10 or 20 years now, and this is simply because these galaxies are very small. They live in fairly shallow gravitational potential wells. So if they form some stars, and those early stars go off in supernova explosions, the energy that's pumped into the environment by those supernova feedback, as we often call it, is sufficient to heat a lot of the surrounding gas, or maybe even blow it out of the galaxy, and prevent that from forming any new stars. And this means that these, at this low mass or low luminosity end, the galaxies, they don't grow as much as you might predict if the amount of light came out was simply proportional to the amount of mass that was there in dark matter. They end up to be a lot smaller, or there's a lot fewer of them because of this. Now, the bright end has been historically much more of a problem. For many, many years, nobody really understood why the models predicted so many more bright galaxies than we observed, why they weren't there in the real universe. And also, we found that the galaxies that we observed in the universe tended to be red, comprised of old stars without much ongoing star formation. The most massive galaxies is the elliptical galaxies. But whereas the models predicted these would be relatively blue, with a reasonable amount of ongoing star formation. And what was happening in the models was simply further gas was falling into the galaxies and forming stars. Young stars tend to look quite blue because they contain a lot of massive stars, which are short-lived, and massive stars are very luminous and blue, and they dominate the light of the galaxy. Whereas the old stars, if star formation stops, only the lower mass stars remain in the galaxy. The higher mass stars have died already, and these are much redder. Mm. So the models predicted that we should see ongoing star formation, which would carry on increasing the mass of the galaxy and make the galaxy appear bluer, and that was very much in contrast with observations.
What we saw were fewer galaxies, and those that we did see were red.
Yes, exactly. And so something was clearly missing in the models. What the models simply did was to introduce some artificial way of stopping the gas cooling, but with no real physical understanding behind that. And what's changed in the last couple of years is people are beginning to get a feel for what might be causing this problem. And this is this particular class of galaxy called active galactic nuclei, in particular those that emit predominantly in the radio wave band, so they're often called radio sources, mostly low luminosity or relatively low luminosity radio sources. And these pump out energy into their environment as the active galactic nucleus. An active galactic nucleus is a black hole, a very massive black hole at the centre of a galaxy that's accreting material, and the sort of gravitational energy that's that's released as this material falls towards the black hole actually emits a copious amount of energy. In terms of, it comes out to be about 10% of the rest mass energy of the enfalling material. The rest mass energy is just mc squared, where m is the mass of the particle, Einstein's famous equation. And much of this energy for these low luminosity radio sources comes out in the form of jets of material from emitted close to the black hole that travel out into the galaxy over very large distances, thousands of light years, in some cases even millions of light years. And this energy can then be deposited back into the galaxy, and it can reheat some of the gas that would otherwise cool and form stars, and stop it from doing so. And this is why we don't see the galaxies continuing to grow, and why we do see them to be red, because they have no recent star formation.
So in the same way that supernovae in the fainter galaxies blow out the gas in the galaxy, turning off star formation, so do the AGN in the more massive galaxies blow out the gas, or at least stop it from condensing into stars, and turns off the star formation.
Yes, that's right.
And we should point out that it's not just, we're not talking about, you know, a slight discrepancy here between what the models were telling us at the bright and the faint end of the galaxy number counts. Yeah. We're talking, there's a big difference, right, between what the models were predicting and what we actually saw.
Yes, I mean, if you take the model and you predict that the light simply follows the mass, then at the bright end we were out by a factor of 10 in terms of the number of galaxies we predict. Now, obviously, we've long known that this is wrong and there should be some missing physics. And as I say, little hand-waving tweaks have been put into the models to make this right. And what's coming now is the physical understanding of what's causing those tweaks.
So through the addition of some messy astrophysics into our models, have we achieved a correlation? Have we achieved a match to what we observe?
Yes. So the models have now, since about 2006, they've put in this. Now, I should say that many of these models have to implement these messy astrophysics, as we call it, in fairly simplified ways if we want to model the whole of galaxy evolution. And since about 2006, sort of simple prescriptions for how radio AGN feedback might work have been incorporated. And indeed, they now do predict galaxy luminosity functions and many other properties of the galaxies and their distribution that very much match with observations, not just in the local universe, but also going out in redshift. My interest is in trying to understand how some of this messy physics works. I should say I'm not one of the people that does much of the modelling. I'm more about trying to observe the radio sources and come to understand how it is that the radio AGN do feed energy into their environment, and to try to observationally test whether the amount of energy that comes out of radio AGN activity is the right amount that we need. So to try to understand some of the messy astrophysics that we put into the model. And in the local universe, that does seem to work. The amount of energy that the radio AGN put into their environment is the right amount that we need to stop the gas from cooling. That's what recent observations show us.
Bringing us neatly onto the next topic, which is your involvement in LOFAR. You are the scientific coordinator for LOFAR. Tell us a little bit about LOFAR.
Well, so the scientific coordinator for the UK part of LOFAR. LOFAR is the Low Frequency Array, which is a new radio telescope that's being built in the Netherlands, but with extension around Europe to other countries, including the United Kingdom. And we have a project called LOFAR UK, which is concerned with building part of the LOFAR array here in the United Kingdom, and I'm the scientific coordinator for that project. A LOFAR is a new type of radio telescope. It's not like the traditional dish telescope that you might see out at Jodrell Bank. Rather, it's just a collection of wires and tiny dipoles spread in fields across the Netherlands and now across Europe. And these are then connected together by incredibly powerful computers. And the main, with a software telescope, the dipoles can image essentially every dipole sees the whole sky at all times, and the trick is in the computation and in the software to then correlate these together in such a way as to make images in certain directions. And the limitations are essentially only set by how fast you can transfer data from each station to the central correlator and how quickly you can correlate it all together. I mean, in principle, with a powerful enough computer and fast enough data transports, you could image the entire sky continuously at all times. In reality, computers aren't that fast nowadays. The main correlator in the Netherlands is a BlueJean computers, one of the fastest 10 computers in the entire world. And we can image reasonable areas of sky, maybe 30 square degrees or so, but not the whole sky at once.
LOFAR is an interferometer. Yes. Now, we've got radio interferometers already. What's different about LOFAR, apart from the fact that you can observe the entire sky, although we can do that with other interferometers as well? What's different about LOFAR?
Okay, so two things are different about LOFAR. Firstly, it works at low radio frequencies. Most of the current interferometers we have work at much higher radio frequencies, around a gigahertz or a few gigahertz, some maybe a little bit under a gigahertz. LOFAR works down in the regime between 30 megahertz and 200 megahertz. This is a very new area of the universe, and we expect some different astrophysical phenomena going on there. There are some particular parts of astrophysics one can only observe at these frequencies. For example, Jupiter is a very much a low frequency emitter, and the Sun. So if you want to do solar system astrophysics, you really need to go to low radio wavelengths. You can't do it with high radio frequencies. But one of the other main things, as well as opening up this new window on the universe, is simply the fact that we can image such large areas of sky with LOFAR. This makes it a fantastic instrument for very deep, wide surveys, but also as a monitor of the sky for any transient phenomena, things that go off and come on and go off rapidly, like maybe pulsars or supernova gamma ray bursts. So it's going to be very exciting for those.
In the context of solving the problem, or at least refining the answer to the problem about AGN feedback and the galaxy luminosity function, how will LOFAR help?
So, as I said before, locally in the nearby universe, we've been able to do studies that show that the amount of energy coming out of the galaxies in the form of radio sources, the radio AGN feedback, if you like, is the right amount to prevent cooling. But galaxy formation didn't mostly happen in the nearby universe. Massive galaxies formed at much greater distances, higher redshift. Back when the universe was only perhaps a third or a half of its age is the peak epoch of star and galaxy formation. It's also the peak epoch of AGN activity. So we can see that the radio sources are retaining the massive galaxies as being old, red and dead without any much ongoing star formation or gas accretion. What we really want to understand is how this worked at much earlier cosmic epochs. So when did this radio AGN feedback really begin to become important, and how did it work at high redshifts? And this is one of the things that LOFAR will be great for, because what we need to do this is very much deeper and wider radio surveys than we've ever been able to carry out before. And LOFAR is going to, with its wide survey capabilities, it's going to open up a revolutionary new window for doing this.
If LOFAR is going to be a deep survey and it can presumably see out to the redshift bellies that you require, why do you need such a large area survey?
Okay, so there's two reasons for this. Firstly, obviously the wider area that you survey, the more sources that you will detect. And if you want to get very good statistics, and this is what we need to sample sources at all different radio luminosities at high redshift, then that's what you need. You need enough galaxies, enough radio sources to do this. But perhaps more fundamentally than this is the fact that the universe is made up of all these dark matter clumps that grow and clump together. And these clump together on many different scales. We've talked about them clumping into galaxies. But on much larger scales than this, they also clump together perhaps into large clusters of galaxies where a large halos of dark matter all form together, and many galaxies form in the same region of space. And in other regions of space, there are what we call voids, where there's very low density of the universe, and there's not much galaxy formation going on there. And the typical scales for this to happen, typical scales at high redshift, is maybe on the degree or so scale. So if you want to observe a fair sample of the universe, you really need to be covering many tens of square degrees. If you only observed over the small survey areas that are possible with other radio interferometers, fractions of square degrees, even if you took many multiple fields, you could by chance be picking only regions with clusters in it or only regions with voids, and you can never be sure that you're sampling a fair region of the universe. Particularly if we want to look at how these feedback processes depend upon environment. Are they different for galaxies within clusters than from galaxies within sort of more field-like regions in the lower density regions? You really have to sample enough volume of the universe to pick out all possible environments that galaxies can live in. Back at a redshift of 2, when the universe was about a quarter of its current age, you need to be surveying about 20 to 30 square degrees as an absolute minimum if you want to pick up all environments. And that simply isn't possible to do to the required depths with the current generation of radio interferometers.
Right. What's the current status of LOFAR?
So LOFAR is under construction at the moment. It'll be, as with any interferometer, it's going to be made up of lots of different stations. In terms of a standard interferometer, these are all dishes, but with LOFAR, it's stations of dipoles. The first station has been operational since 2007, and it's made its first maps of the entire northern sky. But obviously with just one station, we can't go very deep, and the angular resolution is very poor. It's going to have in total about 50 or 60 stations in the end, and between a third and a half of those are going to be installed in the early part of 2009. And by mid-2009, it should be taking its first survey data. And the whole array should be completed sometime in 2010.
You mentioned that there might be some stations built in the UK. Where will they be?
Yes, so we have already raised enough funding for one station within the UK, and this will be located at Chilbolton, which is the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory land, midway between Oxford and Southampton. We're hoping to get at least another two stations. If we had two further stations, one will be located at Jodrell and one at Lord's Bridge in Cambridge. And we have a funding bid into the STFC, the Science and Technology Facilities Council, in order to try to get funding for those, and also to try to get some technical manpower to solve some of the issues that involve working at low radio frequencies.
Well, we wish you all the very best for that bid and for the research, which I'm sure LOFAR will be providing very soon. Thank you very much for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you.